Hi, good morning. My name is Esther Hong. I'm an analyst here at Janney covering Spec Pharma and Biotech. It's my pleasure to introduce our next company, Aldeyra Therapeutics. With us today, we have CEO and President Tom Brady, and we also have Dave McMullen, COO. We'll have Todd give an overview of the company, and then we'll jump into Q&A.
Thanks, Esther, and thanks for hosting us. We're so pleased to be here today, and thank you all for coming. Aldeyra is a novel biotechnology company. We're now in four phase three programs. We're focused on immunology and inflammation and have made tremendous progress over the last couple of years, which we're very pleased about. We have a fascinating Q4 coming up, so our talk today is quite timely. We're initiating our first phase three in the retina, a retinal disease called proliferative vitreoretinopathy, which is orphan and has no therapy. That phase three will begin in Q4. We also have a meeting with the Food and Drug Administration coming up regarding another phase three program of ours in allergic conjunctivitis. We're developing what we think is the first new approach in allergic conjunctivitis in about 40 years, if you could believe it. And we look forward to giving the street some guidance on our subsequent phase three testing in allergic conjunctivitis in Q4. As you know, earlier this year, we posted our first positive phase three in allergic conjunctivitis, the Alleviate trial, which was highly statistically significant. And we look forward to attempting to continue that streak as we move forward into our next phase three program in allergic conjunctivitis. And then finally, we will complete the first part of our dry eye disease phase three trial in Q4. That is the RENEW part one trial. RENEW is an adaptive trial, and we're excited to complete the first part of that. Dry eye, obviously, like allergic conjunctivitis, affects tens of millions of patients in the United States. And in both conditions, I think both physicians and patients would argue that therapy is suboptimal. So a lot going on, and a lot going on in the pipeline, things I haven't discussed. We have various immune modulating approaches, a drug that we licensed some years ago that will be entering a phase two trial, we hope this year, in post-transplant lymphoproliferative disorder, which is a lymphoma-like immune condition that patients get after solid organ transplant. We are also initiating phase one with an oral RASP inhibitor for a variety of immune-mediated conditions that will also initiate this year. So a busy time at Aldeyra, particularly interesting Q4 coming up, and pleased to talk about that today with you, Esther.
Great. Well, let's start with the lead program, dry eye disease. Can you remind us of phase two data that we've seen and the trial design and how that trial design compares to the ongoing phase three study?
We like to keep our phase threes similar to the phase twos, and we've certainly done that in dry eye disease. Typically, in dry eye disease trials, you enroll patients with moderate severity. You make sure those patients don't respond to vehicle, as many of them do. And the patients that don't are then enrolled into the main trial. This is exactly what we did in phase two. We're doing it in phase three. We're looking at essentially the same endpoints. The FDA requires for approval positive results in a symptom, which in this case will be ocular dryness as assessed by the patient, and also a sign. A sign means something that a physician can evaluate that assesses the severity of the disease. And like many companies before us in the dry disease space, we have selected ocular staining. That's when a fluorescent dye is applied via an eye drop to the front of the eye. There's a slit lamp exam, and then the physician is able to quantify the epithelial integrity, that is the cells in the front of the cornea, how well they're holding together. Over time, dry eye disease patients, because their eye is dry and the eyelid is dry, they rub off that epithelial lining and you can see defects with the staining exam. In phase 2B, we posted remarkably statistically significant results in both dryness and staining. Thus, we are continuing to assess those endpoints in the RENEW trial.
So the phase 2B data, the phase 2B trial, the patient numbers were about 100 per arm. So, you know, in the 0.25% reproxalap arm, there were 100 patients. In the vehicle, there were 100. It's the exact same number of patients in this ongoing part one. And so with a very similar study, you know, very likely that we'll see robust results. And so what are the expectations around the part one study, and what would it take to unblind the study?
The question of the year. That is a great question. What will we see out of the first part of the phase three? Adaptive trials, by definition, are sort of designed to power subsequent parts of the trial. So part one is designed to A, confirm what we saw in phase 2B with dryness and staining, and B, power the second part of the trial, that is RENEW 2. But as you point out, the trial is roughly the same size as phase 2B, so there is a chance that we could see statistically significant changes in either dryness or staining. Now, what would it take us to stop, for us to stop the trial? I guess if both co-primaries were achieved, one could theoretically stop the trial, declare victory, and then initiate a confirmatory phase three subsequently. The FDA has in the past in dry eye programs also allowed companies to achieve either a sign or a symptom in a single trial and count that as a trial that could be used for subsequent NDA filing. So it could be that staining is achieved, or it could be that dryness is achieved, and then subsequently we only need to hit staining or dryness, whichever is achieved, one more time, and we can focus on the other endpoint. So I think there's lots of combinations. Whether we stop the trial, we'll just have to see the data. If we don't stop the trial and we move forward, it's still very, very good news. It means that we've seen an effect size that we can then power and move on to part two of RENEW. That's a positive signal. The only bad news would be if we didn't see an effect size and we couldn't power subsequent clinical testing, and then the program would cease at that point. But based on the phase 2B data, I think that is highly unlikely, as you point out.
So this is probably jumping too far ahead, but what would a confirmatory phase 3 trial look like, assuming we see stat sig on both co-primary endpoints?
I think it would look very similar, probably bigger, just to make sure that the trial is powered appropriately, but that depends on the effect size we see in RENEW Part 1. We're big believers in not changing very much from trial to trial once we've seen success. I think it makes the most statistical sense to keep going with what works, and that's what we would intend to do here.
So let's talk about the market opportunity for reproxalap in dry eye disease. How is reproxalap different from Restasis and Xiidra? If you can comment on that.
Right. I'll turn it over to Dave McMullen, our Chief Commercial Officer.
Thanks,
Todd,
and thanks for the question, Esther. So reproxalap has a really unique profile that we're seeing in clinical development that differentiates it from existing standard of care. So if you look at Restasis and Xiidra, those are products that are on the market, and when they're used by the doctors, it's not uncommon for doctors to set expectations with their patients that they'll have to stick with the treatment to see the effect. And that's because they're generally known to take some time to show an effect. So there's this need that the market's playing back for something that happens that can show its effect rapidly. Now in our phase 2A, we did our first time point at 1 week. In our phase 2B, we did our first time point at 2 weeks. In both of those programs, we saw a strong and statistically significant effect at that first measure. So that early onset of action is something that we're seeing in reproxalap that can be a differentiator for the benefit of patients and physicians who are treating them. In our current ongoing phase 3 program, we're studying both 1 week and 2 week, and the goal is to show a replication of what we saw in the phase 2 program. Another thing that we've seen in our phase 2 clinical trials is a broad effect across signs and symptoms. And when we profile this, and even we put a slide in our corporate deck to illustrate this, but when we show our profile with physicians, that's one of the first things they remark on. They say, wow, it's really interesting that it's showing this positive, consistent positive efficacy across all of these sign measures, whether it's tier quality, quantity type of measures, or cell damage measures, and also the symptom measures, whether it's severity or frequency, and that unique and broad positive improvement across those signs and symptoms, we believe is also unique and differentiating for Reproxa. And we hope that that will translate into the real world experience where more patients get a benefit from using the drug, because it seems to be very effective across all these different signs and symptoms. So while in our phase three program, we have declared one primary symptom and one primary sign, that's for regulatory purposes. We're also looking across the battery of signs and symptoms as a secondary measure, so we can continue to see that.
So compared to what's out there, it seems that the market is large. Is competition even an issue? Do you see the market expanding? What are your thoughts there?
So the market need is definitely large, and we believe it's only growing. This is a condition that affects the aging population. Also, there's many aspects of our lifestyle that are contributing to more and more people dealing with a dryness in their eyes. Also, the current standard of care from a therapeutic perspective, they simply are not good enough for most people to be able to manage their disease. So there are the majority of dry eye patients are not satisfied with the treatment that they're able to achieve or get from existing products. If you look at what's available in the clinical development pipeline, I think it really highlights our potential, because we're really the lead novel compound that's out there, and there is nothing else that's kind of close from a competitive clinical development perspective. So this is a condition that's very large. Patients and doctors are looking for something new. It's an indication that's going to grow because of the demographics of society, and we're well poised to bring to market a solution that will be a great fit.
So there's also an ongoing trial for a novel formulation of Reproxalab. Can you speak about that?
Happy to. Esther, we're always looking to improve our formulations, and I think it's wise for any biotech company to think about the commercial optimization and line extension of the product. So this is one such example where we have very slightly tweaked the concentration of excipients. We haven't changed any excipients, but a small change in the concentration, really designed to increase the residence time of drug in the eye. You know, our eyeballs are really good at getting rid of stuff, right? We're really designed to eliminate dust and particles and foreign substances from our eyes. We blink, we tear, we rub. And so administering a topical ocular drug is challenging for those reasons. But we believe we've found a way to increase the amount of time that drug can reside on the ocular surface. That's the intent of the formulation trial in dry eye disease. I will note it is very similar to Renew Part 1 in terms of the numbers of patients, the trial design, the endpoints, and so forth. So our view is that the formulation trial represents yet another shot on goal for achieving statistical significance in a sign or a symptom or both. The other thing I'll add in conjunction with the formulation trial, Renew Part 1 is really two different trials wrapped into one. So there is a 4 times a day dosing trial. There is a 4 times a day to twice a day dosing trial, each one with its own vehicle control. So if you think about the ways we could demonstrate activity in a sign or a symptom, there's really three different ways. The two parts of Renew Part 1, the two sub-trials, and then the formulation trial, which we're very excited about. We have completed enrollment in all of those trials, so you'll certainly hear about the completion of Renew Part 1 in Q4, and then I hope soon thereafter the formulation trial.
Okay, great. Great. So earlier this year, it was announced that Reproxalap did not meet the primary the endpoints in the SOLACE trial for uveitis. Can you speak a little bit about what happened there and how that disease is different from dry eye disease or and allergic conjunctivitis?
Uveitis is really its own animal. It's not an ocular surface disease. The uvea, that is that part of the eye that's inflamed in uveitis, is really comprised of the iris and structures sort of posterior to the front of the eye, that is behind the front of the eye. It's also an autoimmune disease. So uveitis is its own little animal. It's often known as one of the most severe ocular inflammatory conditions. It's a high bar. We were statistically not inferior to steroid in phase two testings. Corticosteroids are the big gun in this disease and many ocular inflammatory diseases. The problem with steroids is toxicity, glaucoma, and cataracts and so forth. When we ran the SOLACE trial, what we found is that a lot of the milder patients in uveitis just get better on their own. There's a lot of self-resolution that had never before been described. In fact, this was the largest ever vehicle control trial in non-infectious anterior uveitis. What we've learned is that the grade one patients, there's sort of four grades of uveitis. We tested grades one through three. A lot of the grade one patients just get better on their own, which has really interesting implications for physicians. Should you treat those patients at all? I think the results from SOLACE, which suggests that in milder patients, probably a wait and see approach, an observation approach, is more prudent than exposing patients unnecessarily to the toxicities of steroid. At any rate, what we did see is in grade two patients, which sort of moderate severity patients, the drug was statistically superior to vehicle. And we announced that we're not moving forward in uveitis, not so much because the drug didn't work or there wasn't a path forward in grade twos. It was more that given dry eye disease, given allergic conjunctivitis, given that we're still a small company and like any other biotech company, somewhat resource constrained, we're going to focus our efforts on dry eye disease and allergic conjunctivitis and some of the other immune-mediated approaches that we talked about, including our phase three program in the retina that'll begin next quarter, and the oral program and our chaperone modulators and so forth. So that's really the story behind uveitis. I think there's very, very little read-through to any ocular surface disease, which would include dry eye disease and allergic conjunctivitis.
So segueing into allergic conjunctivitis, can you remind us of the data to date that we've seen? We saw really impressive phase three data earlier this year, phase three data. So if you can speak about that and give us an update.
We're so thrilled about allergic conjunctivitis. I mean, like I mentioned, there really hasn't been anything new in about 40 years. The first antihistamine came out in 1947, Park Davis marketed Benadryl. And then attempted to convince the medical community that allergy was only histamine, which is, of course, false. We've had some minor advancements since then, but today, really, the only treatment after antihistamines is steroids, and about half the patients don't really respond well to antihistamines. The way to test a drug in allergy, in ocular allergy, is to expose patients to allergen. There's two ways of doing that. One, you can put the allergen right in the eye. That's called a conjunctival allergen challenge. That was the subject of the Alleviate phase three trial. We just crushed it. I mean, statistically, extremely low p-values. There's no doubt the drug is statistically superior to vehicle. Because we have a novel chemical entity, that is Reproxalap, because we have a novel target, that is RAS, and because the approach in general is quite new. We've been in constant dialogue with the FDA about different ways of demonstrating activity in allergic conjunctivitis. So its benefits, it's not only from a regulatory standpoint, but also from a commercial standpoint. That is the subject of our FDA meeting later this year, the next phase three trial. There's a couple of different ways to test response to allergen aside from the conjunctival challenge. One is a field trial, where you just give patients drug during allergy season and they have a diary and they rate itching. Another one is the so-called allergen chamber, where people sit in a room much smaller than this one and they blow a defined amount of pollen into the air. And the patients sit there with their iPads and they have to keep their eyes open and they rate their itching, and the investigator comes in and rates redness, and patients will assess their tearing and so forth and so on. That's a little bit more controlled than the field trial, but still a pretty high bar. You can't exactly control how much pollen goes in each subject's eyes. They sit in this room and wait for 3 or 4 hours. We did release chamber data earlier this year, middle of the year, in June or so. The data were outstanding. A clear statistical effect of drug over vehicle, not only in terms of the reduction of itching as reported by the patient, but also in terms of the reduction of ocular redness as assessed by the investigators. Mm-hmm. So absolutely thrilled to see those data, and are going to be very pleased, I think, to announce the results of our discussions with the FDA later this year about subsequent testing.
Okay, great. So coming up next month at the AAO meeting in San Francisco, the company will have a poster presentation on allergic conjunctivitis. Can you give us any details on what we can expect to see?
So one of the things we always try and do is, after a data release, publish a fuller set of trial data at a conference. And at some point, we hope to follow it up with a publication. The AAO, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, release in the fall of this year will include a larger set of results from the Alleviate trial. I think the gist will still be the same, that is that the drug was highly active, but there should be a few interesting nuggets in there additionally that haven't been disclosed previously.
Okay. Great. So with allergic conjunctivitis, the phase 3 study, assuming it's a chamber study, what can we expect for a trial design?
I think pending regulatory discussions and per our earlier conversation about keeping phase 3 the same as phase 2, I have the feeling that the chamber trial will look and feel very similar to the trial that we described previously, and we'll describe in more detail, I think, once we hear back from the FDA. But in general, patients are exposed to either drug or vehicle. They're in the chamber for 3.5 to 4 hours. They rate itch, they rate tearing, and they have investigator ratings of redness. We, in the initial chamber trial, gave the drug just before they went into the chamber, about 5 minutes before, and then we readministered drug about 90 minutes into the challenge. The reason for that is in the chamber, itching peaks at about 90 minutes. So the difficult part is administering a drug once itching has peaked. We were thrilled to see that in that second dose of drug at about 90 minutes peak itching, there was a reduction in itching in drug-treated patients that was clearly, not only visibly, but statistically better than vehicle. So not only is there a preventative or prophylactic aspect of the chamber where you could administer drug before the chamber, but also a so-called treatment aspect of assessment where you can administer drug during peak symptoms. We've proposed to the agency that we do both, and we'll see what we can agree upon going forward.
Great. So let's talk about the market opportunity for Reproxalap in allergic conjunctivitis. This drug is not going to be competing with antihistamines because of the onset of action and the durable effect. But if you can just frame up the market opportunity for us, and then also speak about why a physician who prescribes Reproxalap for dry eye disease would also prescribe it for allergic conjunctivitis.
Yeah, so as Todd said earlier, in allergic conjunctivitis, antihistamines work on the histaminic response. It's a very short-lived response. We have a fundamentally different mechanism of action. So we don't think of our mechanism of action as displacing antihistamines. What our message is antihistamine, the histamine is, itself is not the whole story. And you can see this in the marketplace just by current dynamics. We all know that histamines are available over the counter. An allergic conjunctivitis sufferer, the first thing that they will likely do is go to their pharmacy and try something out. For those for whom that is not enough, end up going to their doctor, end up at their eye doctor. Today, what happens frequently is the doctor just prescribes a higher dose of antihistamine or a different antihistamine that's available by prescription only. That is just amping up that one mechanism of action. It's still only addressing really that bolus of histaminic response that comes from the mast cells. And we see in the marketplace that another class of drugs is being used more frequently than many people realize, and that is our steroids. Steroids are often being prescribed by physicians to help these patients who are coming to them. And steroids have a mechanism of action that's gentle in its effect. We also know that steroids take time to have their effect. So when steroids have been studied in allergic conjunctivitis, there's a two-week run-in where you have patients take the drug for 2 weeks before you actually challenge them with an allergen. That's because of the mechanism of action. Here with Reproxalap, I should also say there's a limitation as well with the steroid side effects and toxicities that you should be careful not to use them long-term and only use them for a short period of time. Now with Reproxalap, we have a brand new mechanism of action that can complement the histamine mechanism of action, and it's also safe. We've never seen any of the side effects that are related to steroids with our product in development, and we're now in close to 1,000 patients across all our studies in the eye. And we have the ability with our mechanism of action to provide a benefit immediately. So if the patient is coming in and suffering, even if it's in the middle of the season, there's no longer a need to sort of wait for a mechanism of action to kick in and provide help and assistance. With our clinical data, we have shown that in the midst of that allergen challenge, we can provide a benefit. We can reduce statistically significant itching and redness. So that's the way we're looking at positioning the product right now. Obviously, this will continue to evolve as we generate additional clinical data, but that's a very large marketplace for these millions of patients who are going to their doctors, and again, based on our research, between 10 and 15% of them are receiving steroids on a routine basis, season after season, to help manage their symptoms.
And the overlap.
And then your question regarding the overlap. We have seen, so right now we are studying Reproxalap independently for an indication in dry eye disease and an indication in allergic conjunctivitis. These are two independent clinical programs. What we have observed come up again and again in our market research is the very real fact that these two diseases overlap tremendously. There's published literature that demonstrates this, an overlap of patients who suffer from dry eye disease and allergic conjunctivitis. When you talk to doctors, they do recognize there are patients who come in for dry eye disease and are also suffering from allergic conjunctivitis. And when you talk to patients, you just doing market research, you run into these patients who have both and they talk about it. And the way they talk about it is very interesting. And that's because of the treatments that are currently available. So antihistamines that are used to treat allergic conjunctivitis, they dry the eyes out. That's a class effect, it's well known. And I've heard patients in their market research speak about the difficulties that they suffer from trying to manage their allergic conjunctivitis during an allergy season. And they say literally, like, I know I have to start taking my antihistamine because it dries my eyes out. It exacerbates the symptoms that I'm suffering from. We also know that the two compounds that are currently approved for dry eye disease were studied in allergic conjunctivitis, and those clinical programs were stopped. In some instances, the data is publicly available, allergic itch got worse with use of those products. And so we see the potential for a unique value proposition for Reproxalap in demonstrating that it can manage across these two indications that have a high degree of overlap. There's potential in the future to even study that explicitly through a clinical program. But if I'm a doctor today and I'm dealing with patients who happen to have these two diseases together, right now I have two separate sets of therapeutic options, neither of which are a great fit for that overlap. Reproxalap in the future could be a solution where you can use it without any worry of having an exacerbating effect on the symptoms of one or the other diseases.
But the doses are different, so how should we think about the doses are different between allergic conjunctivitis and dry eye disease. How will physicians manage that?
Yeah, so that in terms of the dosing, so the formula that we're studying 0.25% in both of them. Mm-hmm. And for dry eye disease, we are studying two different dosing regimens, so four times a day and four times a day tapering down to twice a day. For four times a day, we can hit the disease hard. By tapering down to twice a day, you can treat a chronic treatment. Allergic conjunctivitis is similar in that it's a very symptomatic disease. So it is a disease that once you have it, it doesn't go away, but the symptoms come and go. And when they come, you administer the drug to help keep the symptoms at bay. We're developing a dosing paradigm that allows us that flexibility. So we are demonstrating the safety as well as the efficacy to be able to use it in that flexible manner so that a doctor could prescribe the product to a patient. And the patient would know that on a bad day, when symptoms are worse, they can take it to help reduce the symptomatology that they're facing.
I just got to add, I'm so excited by the allergic conjunctivitis market. I think it is the next biggest market in topical ophthalmology. Everyone focuses on dry eye, but a third of the world has allergic conjunctivitis, including myself. And as Dave mentioned, there's just very little after antihistamines unless you want to go to a steroid. I personally would never take a topical ocular steroid unless things were really, really bad, because I don't want to deal with the toxicities. If we pursue a chamber trial in phase three, I think we'll have the most comprehensive regulatory package ever in allergic conjunctivitis. I think, as Dave says, we'll be able to demonstrate a treatment effect, we'll be able to demonstrate a prophylactic effect. No drug has ever been shown in the chamber to be active in a large systematic phase three trial. We're thrilled to be at the forefront of what I think is just a tremendous market.
Great. So just with the little bit of time that we have left, if we could talk about PVR. That's a really exciting indication. The drug is really exciting. You guys in-licensed it earlier this year with great terms. If you could speak about the lack of treatment right now and how your drug potentially addresses that issue.
Yeah, PVR is a really terrible condition. What happens is in certain numbers of patients, the retina detaches from the back of the eyeball. The problem isn't reattaching the retina. That can be done. It's that scarring happens. So when you repair a wound, you get a scar. And in many cases, that scar causes further retinal detachment because it pushes the retina back off. It's also impossible to see through a scar. So it's this vicious cycle where eventually patients lose vision. Now, amazingly, there is no therapy for PVR. And the company we bought earlier this year, an outstanding retinal surgeon out of Mass Eye and Ear, discovered that when administering this compound, patients after retinal surgery didn't scar. And then ran an investigator-sponsored trial out of Mass Eye and Ear and discovered that the rates of PVR formation after drug administration went way down, far below what anyone would ever expect after retinal detachment surgery. So we're thrilled to be part of that story and excited to launch the phase three in Q4 of this year. But it's nice to be working in an area where there's no therapy, a tremendous unmet medical need, where the alternative is to do nothing, and many of those patients eventually go blind.
And then what is the potential market opportunity there?
So right now there are many people who have retinal detachments. Depending on various risk factors, you may or may not, this rare disease of PVR may or may not emerge. We estimate that on an annual basis, there's 4,000 new cases in the U.S. and more than twice as many in Europe and Japan. That's our starting point. With this drug, we have the potential to further develop the profile to potentially show that it can also prevent the onset of PVR. So there's expansion, lifecycle management expansion opportunities beyond that number.
Okay, great. And then just briefly, a few more details on this expansive pipeline that you have. Probably not enough time, but if you can just go into more details on what's coming up, the trials that are starting, the impressive data that we saw last year.
Yes, we're excited about the pipeline. I've never been a believer in putting all your eggs in one basket in biotech. I think that's a recipe for disaster. Fortunately, as almost everything we've worked on has worked in some fashion or another, and have a little bit of embarrassment of riches with it, such a large and growing pipeline. Our general theme is that the platform we have for immune modulation doesn't just apply to the eye. Now, we started in the eye. The eye is a great organ to start with. You can inject drug into it. You can bathe the front of the eye with eye drops. And in many cases, the diseases can be assessed non-invasively, so they're not that expensive. The clinical trials aren't that expensive. You don't have to treat them for years or months. The diseases progress fairly rapidly. But it's time to move beyond the eye. And we are intent on doing that. We have initiated a systemic program. It's an orally available RASP inhibitor. And phase one testing we hope to begin this year. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a chaperone modulator from a drug we licensed some years ago that will begin testing in PTLD, I hope, by the end of this year. That drug is also the subject of two investigator-sponsored trials in cancer, ovarian cancer and mesothelioma. So lots of different ways, different approaches in our pipeline to demonstrate success. We're really not dependent on one compound. We're not dependent on one mechanism of action, and we're certainly not dependent on one indication. I think we have a bright future in terms of the diversity of what we have testing right now.
Thanks. Maybe just on the heels of that last question, you know, looking at Esther's most recent report, and that pipeline and that list of current events is long. It's an embarrassment of riches, but how challenging is that to manage, and how expensive is it to support?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I mean, it's a conundrum in biotech. If you don't want to restrict your upside to one drug or one trial, then how diverse do you go? Because we have finite resources, we have a finite number of people, and a finite amount of time. I think that's part of the art of biotech, though. That's one reason we shifted ADX-1612 to investigator-sponsored trials in cancer. We just don't have the bandwidth or the resources internally to run cancer trials on our own. It is cancer, sure, it's an immune-mediated disease, but it's not right in our crosshairs of development expertise. So that's one mechanism we've used, is the investigator-sponsored trials. A little bit of other people's money to test those programs. I think the other thing is that we're just in the early stage of the systemic stages of systemic testing. That's very manageable. And once we get into the phase 2Bs and the phase 3s, I think then there's the chance to partner out. And obviously, we don't intend to partner everything, but selective partnering can be a very good thing, not only because it helps us with time and resources and money, but also because it could be a source of non-dilutive capital as we move down the road.
All right, so is there anything that I didn't ask that I should have asked? I mean, there's a lot of really exciting things going on, and I think that the upcoming part one phase three renew data readout is underappreciated. I think it's gonna be a big event, and so look forward to it.
Thanks, Esther, and thanks again for inviting us.